And you're right. You spend most of the time by yourself. You know, you're sitting at the computer or you're taking walks or you're thinking about your next book. And then you go out in the world, you interview somebody, you know, and then you get to write about them. And then you come back into your little world and all. And I've never been bored with my life.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dustin Richardson from the Burbank International Film Festival. And today we continue our interview series, Real Conversations, with special guest Lawrence Grobel. Larry has been an amazing voice in the entertainment industry for years as a talented novelist, journalist, screenwriter, poet, and adventurer. He's written over 30 books and for several national magazines and newspapers. Some of his work includes books on iconic talent such as Al Pacino, Marlon Brando, Barbara Streisand, and Meryl Streep. That's quite a list, but it doesn't end there. He has been fortunate to have spent time with some of the most fascinating people in the world and has so many amazing stories to tell. And today we get to hear from Larry himself. Hello, Larry. Thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm fine, Dustin. Nice to meet you and see you.
Yes, nice to see you too. So you've had so many amazing experiences interviewing and working on the life stories of so many celebrities. And I'm just curious, who are some of your favorite people you've gotten to meet and why did they stand out to you?
You know, it's hard to say who my favorites are because it often changes. But usually it's the people I ended up writing books about, Brando, and Pacino, and James Michener, Truman Capote, John Huston. You know, those were are the people that kind of stand out. But also, you know, I've always been fascinated by writers, and I got to know J.P. Don Levy was a favorite novelist of mine, and I, you know, got to spend time with him, and he came to my house a number of times. And Joyce Carol Oates, and Elmore Leonard, and Allen Ginsberg. So you know, there's a Saul Bellow was a thrill to go and interview. So, you know, it's hard to say about favorites. It's like someone asked me if I had one interview to do, who anyone in the world, who would it be? And I made a list of about eight or so. And then I realized if I'm sitting at a table or invited guests, I would say Oscar Wilde would be a great one because he was so entertaining. Whereas I would love to sit with James Joyce, but I have a feeling he wouldn't talk very much, you know. So it's difficult to say who's the favorite. But the people I mentioned are all people I really enjoy. Dolly Parton, I enjoyed her immensely. I like being around her. Pacino and I became close. That was unusual. Elliot Gould and I became close. Diane Keaton became a friend, you know, and I never interviewed Diane. I just got to know her when she was dating Al and all. I would never give up my time with Marlon Brando, for instance, you know, just spending the time with him. You know, John Huston once told me the thing that bothered him most in life was boredom. He just didn't want to be bored. So even when I was, when he was ill in the last year and a half of his life that I was with him, you know, whenever he went into the hospital, he would call me and say, come on over, Larry, come on over. You know, he just didn't, he couldn't stand being there, but the thing he couldn't stand most was just being there. You know, I mean, he just couldn't be active. He could listen to books on tape, he could read, but you know, his mind wasn't being as challenged. And so, you know, I used to go there, and I'm pretty much the same way. I feel like I'm, you know, when you're a writer, you spend most of the time by yourself. You know, you're sitting at the computer or you're taking walks or you're thinking about your next book. And then you go out in the world, you interview somebody, you know, and then you get to write about them. And then you come back into your little world and all. And I've never been bored with my life. You know, I've never just had nothing to do. I always have something to do. If it's a new story idea or something I want to read or, you know, something I, you know, even if it's to go out and garden a little bit, you know. And I think I take that from John. You know, I've always taken that as something I understood and feel the same way.
Was there anyone you interviewed that ever made you starstruck, or were you always just very comfortable doing that type of work?
Yeah, I mean, the first time I went to see Truman Capote, he lived across the street from the UN, and he wanted to meet at the Le Petit Marmite restaurant. It's a French restaurant. And I remember, you know, flying to New York and walking around the block and thinking, you know, I appreciated his writing a lot. I thought he was a really great writer. He didn't write much, but his words were very well put together. I guess I've been starstruck in a certain way with everybody, you know, because you never know what to expect from anybody. So, but not to the point where I couldn't talk. The only person who ever took my breath away was Dolly Parton, the first time I met her, because that's like meeting Jessica Rabbit. You know, I mean, she was, you know, she's small. She's only 5 feet tall, but she has the hair that's 5 inches. She's got 4-inch heels on. So she's, you know, basically looking at you in your height. And she's so friendly. And, you know, the first thing I did was hug her. I can't believe I'm doing this. I can't believe I'm with her, you know, that kind of stuff. I wasn't starstruck with Barbara Streisand because she reminded me of my sister a lot. You know, I mean, I had a lot of battles with my sister over the years. And Barbara and I ended up doing a lot of battling too, but we went at it, you know, over months. Every time I would see her, we have some kind of argument, but, you know, then we settle in and do the interview. So, you know, Saul Bellow, you know, people whose writing I really, really admired, you know, I would take some deep breaths before I'd go in, you know, because you have to go in as an interviewer as if you are as smart as they are or as knowledgeable. And you're usually not, you know, I mean, you are if you're prepared. I've always felt secure if I was prepared. But when you go to see Linus Pauling, who won 2 Nobel Prizes, or Bellow, who won a Nobel Prize, or Richard Feynman, who won the Nobel Prize for physics, it's audacious to think, oh, I can go one on one with these people and, you know, come out alive. But in a sense, I have to believe that when I go there. And that means my preparation has to be such that even though I don't understand quantum physics too much, I still read a book about quantum physics before I see him, just so I can understand some of the words and some of the language if we get into that. The more I prepared for someone, if I was a movie star, I'd see all the movies they made. I'd read every interview and every profile about that person that I could find. I would talk to people who worked with them. And so it's a lot of preparation for just an interview. And I know a lot of people think I was like crazy. Mark Maron interviewed me on his WTF podcast. And he kept saying, you must be really, you know, mad at me. You probably really hate me. I said, why? He says, well, because I do what you do, except I don't prepare for it. I don't do the research you did. I said, listen, more power to you if you don't have to, but you know, that's just, everybody has a different way of working. And to me, I'm very good at small talk, but I don't think the world needs to have more small talk between me and Joyce Carol Oates or Elmore Leonard or Norman Mailer. I think, you know, I need to read their work. I need to know what they're thinking. And I think that's what people expect when they want to read about those people.
I know you've written about some of this, but for the viewers who don't know out there, how did you become a journalist in this way? And who was your first interview with?
I was 15 years old, and I won an American history essay contest that Newsday in New York sponsored. And the topic was America's 3 greatest presidents. And I won that, and so did another young lady that I, you know, from another school. We got to have our pictures in the newspaper. They published the essay. There were 16 of us. There were 8 contests, and so over 8 months. And at the end of the year, we all went to Washington, D.C., and we were supposed to meet President Kennedy, which was quite something. Kennedy, that weekend, went to Berlin, and he gave his famous speech. We didn't meet Kennedy, but we met Bobby Kennedy. He was attorney general, and we went into his office, and we got to talk to him, and he gave us these little PT-109 pins and tie clips from his brother's campaign. And then we met the head of the FBI, and we met our senators, and we, you know, it was quite something. So I saw at the age of 15 that writing paid, not necessarily in money, but in attention and the people in my school treated me differently after that. You know, I mean, it was a very interesting and unique experience. I always knew I wanted to be a writer, and I was the editor of my school newspaper. And when I went to college at UCLA, I wrote a column for 4 years in the newspaper, and I edited the UCLA magazine, satirical magazine called Seder. I marched in the Mississippi Meredith March, and I reported it on Newsday. So I was writing. I was becoming a writer, basically. I went to Ghana in the Peace Corps. I met a sculptor named Vincent Kofi, and he was a very interesting sculptor. And he's the one who gave me the title for my latest book called Turquoise, because I asked him, what is truth in art to you? And he said, truth is like the color turquoise. It changes under different light. Under artificial light, it's one color. Under natural sunlight, it's a different color. And I thought, that's really fascinating, because that's exactly, you know, a title for me. What is my truth about living in Africa for 3 years? It's my truth. but it's not a Ghanaian's truth, because anything I have to say about Ghana is not going to make sense to them, because it's kind of, you know, I haven't been there long enough. That interview was published in African Arts Magazine. And in a certain way, that would have been my first interview. When I came back to the States after 3 years in Ghana and 1 year traveling around the world, I got back and I called Newsday because I was looking for work. And I said, you know, hey, I've been gone for 4 years and I think I could write for you. And they were just coming out with a new magazine called LI Magazine, Long Island Magazine. And it was like Parade. It was, you know, a Sunday insert. Basically, for the next 6 or 8 months, I stayed in New York and I wrote for that magazine. And it was all kinds of new journalism stuff. It was a lot of fun. I wrote about people whose hobby was collecting fish, or people who was in the demolition derby, going around the derby, crashing into each other, or the Roosevelt Raceway story, and you know where the trotters were racing. And I got to meet the jockeys and the drivers, and I got in the cars, and I jumped out of airplanes, you know, to write about that, and you know, all sorts of things that I was writing about. And then I said, you know, I want to just work on my fiction. So I want to go. I was going to move to. A friend of mine became the director of Antioch College West. He called me and said, "Would you become my assistant director?" And I said, "No, I'm not looking for a job. I want to write, but okay, I'll do it half time." So I came out here to LA to work on that. And as soon as I got an apartment and a telephone, the phone rang. It was amazing. It's like the next day after the phone was installed, and it was the editor from Newsday that I worked for. And he said, "We figured out a way to get off Long Island." So all the articles at the time were based on Long Island. And I said, "What is it?" And he says, "We want to do interviews with household names." I said, "Okay." And they said, "How would you like to interview Mae West?" I said, "Okay, is she still alive?" And they said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, how do I find her?" And they said, "How the hell do we know? You're the one out in Hollywood." And that was it. That was the beginning. So I called around. I looked into. I found out she had done this movie, Myra Breckinridge. Paramount Pictures was still involved with her. So they got me in touch with Mae West. Mae West agreed to see me. I put on a tie and jacket. The only time I ever wore a tie and jacket in all the interviews I've done since. But I got dressed up for her. I went to a flower shop that was near her apartment to bring her flowers. And I went to buy these flowers. And the guy says to me, "Oh, must be a honey, your girlfriend or something." I said, "No, man, I'm going to interview Mae West." "Oh, she doesn't like these flowers. She likes these, the tulips or something, the most expensive flower, right?" I said, "Okay, give me those." So I got those and I went to see Mae West. First thing she did when she came out was look in horror at my tape recorder and said, "Oh, no, no, you can't use that." I said, "Well, why not?" She said, "Well, someone interviewed me once and they made a record out of my voice and I don't want that to happen." And, you know, this is really my first celebrity interview. The other one with the artist was the first real interview that I did with someone. But so I said, "Look, I'll sign something." No, she wouldn't let me do it. So I did my first celebrity interview without a tape recorder. And she talked very slow. So I was able to really scribble down enough to us. And I went home and worked on that. Newsday ended up really liking it. And they said, and I said, "Can I do any household name?" He says, "Who do you have in mind?" And I said, "How about Linus Pauling? How about Ray Bradbury? How about J.P. Donlevy?" I wasn't thinking in terms of celebrities. I was thinking of writers and scientists. And they said, okay to those. But that ran out very quickly. And a household name is usually someone on television or someone in the movies. You know, I mean, those are your most famous people. So I ended up doing Warren Beatty, Lucille Ball, Carol Burnett, Gabe Kaplan, Welcome Back Carter. That's how far back this goes. You know, I did Cher. I did Barbara Streisand was one of those. I did those interviews for a number of years. And then as I was doing them, I said, you know, there's something about this form, there's something about interviewing people that is very interesting, because it allows you, it gives you permission to ask somebody any question you want. And if they don't want to answer it, they don't have to, but they won't punch you in the face or kick you out if you ask them, because they're there to be interviewed. So I wanted to see, after doing all these interviews that were about 2 to 3 hours long, I wondered, what would it be like to talk to somebody for 2 or 3 days, 2 or 3 weeks, for a month? You know, I mean, how good could I do it? You know, how long can I keep asking questions? How deep can I probe a person's personality? that led to, I mean, I did Dolly Parton then, I did Henry Winkler then, I did Luciano Pavarotti. I went to Tahiti. I spent 10 days on Brando's Island, came back here, worked on it. He wanted to come talk to me about something John Wayne had said about the Indians. So he came to my house. I didn't know he was going to come to my house. I thought I was going to his house, and he ended up coming here. And so I had to take down my bulletin board of all Brando's stuff. I'm pulling it off, you know, like this. My wife wasn't home. She was teaching at Cal State Long Beach. So, you know, I had to clean up as much as I could by myself and take the dirty dishes and throw them under the cabinet because I didn't have time to wash because he was on his way, right? And so, and then he came and he spent 5 hours at my house. Then he left. And that's what happened is that after that interview with Brando, I mean, Streisand was big, and I got on the cover of Writer's Digest because of the Streisand one. They put me on the cover. But it was the Brando interview that really changed things, because everybody in Hollywood agreed to talk to me because I became the guy who did Brando. And that's, you know, Pacino was next. And Pacino had never done an interview before. And he was doing Cruising, and Author had just come out. And he just said, you know, when he agreed, he says, okay, I'll do the interview, but I'll only do it with the guy who did Brando, because he loved that interview with Marlon, and he carried it around with him. He ripped it out of the magazine, and he would read it all the time. And he told me this, you know, when I met him. And so, every time he would ask me, give me another copy of the Brando interview, because he would always lose it. So finally, when I put the book out on Brando, I was able to give him the book instead, you know, so he didn't lose it as easily. But that's who I became, the guy who did Brando. So Lily Tomlin would be interested. Barbara Streisand, I would meet her at Elliot Gould's house on a Christmas event or something. And she just came right up to me and told me about Marlon. And we went into the kitchen and we talked about Marlon Brando for half an hour. So, you know, I realized that you know, my life has changed a bit. And I've now entered into a different echelon of interviewer, so to speak. And then I was just, you know, I was able to keep doing it. And I turned down some people. I turned down Clint Eastwood. I turned down Paul Newman, you know, because I was so busy doing things, you know. So, you know, but, you know, in the end, you know, no complaints, you know. I mean, it's been a very enriching experience to do all these things.
You also write some screenplays. I was curious what that entailed. What sort of screenwriting do you do?
I wrote a screenplay based on my Conversations with Brando book. And that's, you know, Anthony Hopkins wanted to do it. Rutger Hauer read it. And he came to L.A. To promote his book. And he met with me and he said, I don't know if I'm big enough for you, but, you know, if I could play Brando. He says, I'll do it, you know. And what do I know? I'm just the writer. I wasn't a producer. And so, you know, and Hopkins, I turned Hopkins down. It's hard to believe, but he pissed me off about something. And I said, you know what, forget you. But so that script's still available. And I think Woody Harrelson would be really good to play Brando. I think that James Spader would be really good to play Brando. Among the, you know, other actors that could do it, those two I've always thought would be good. I showed it to Jeff Bridges, the script, and he liked it. He said, Larry, he's the one who said, I know who should do this. He says, this is Woody Harrelson would be great for this. So I'm grateful for that, but I don't know how to get to Woody Harrelson. I've tried. I've got, you know, tried to get to through his publicist. I haven't had any luck to get to him. You know, I recently got in touch with Fisher Stevens and I said, Fisher, direct this thing, show this as Spader, you know? So I don't know. I sent him the script. I don't know what's happening. So that's where that's at. So that's available. I wrote a few other screenplays as well. One of my first ones was called Canvases. I had done a story about a guy named Joe Kosman, E. Joseph Kosman. He's a guy who created the ant farm in plastic. You know, you'd send away for the ants, you'd buy the vial. He came up with the rubber shrunken head that, you know, you hung from your rearview mirror, you know, that all kinds of bizarre things, toy soldiers, 100 toy soldiers for a dollar that was in comic books. These were all his products. So I thought he was a con man. And I convinced a couple of different magazines to let me write about him. And I went to see him and he wasn't a con man. He was a very genuinely interesting man. And he actually did lectures. You know, people paid $1,000 or $750 to come hear him speak. And he would tell you how to make $1 million in mail order. That's what he wrote a book on. So, and then I also got very involved in the 70s with performance artists. And some of them have become very famous. Chris Burden, who, you know, if you go to the L.A. County Museum, you know the light, the street lights in the front of the museum. That's Chris Burden's work. But he's got his work inside as well. But Chris Burden was got known because of some of the bizarre things he did. He was shot in the arm. He had his lawyer shoot him with a rifle at University of Irvine as part of his graduate program. And it was the shot heard around the art world. It made the cover of some magazines and whatever. And then Paul McCarthy, who is now one of the leading artists, so his work sells for millions of dollars. Well, Paul was a struggling artist that, you know, I helped him out by giving him $50 for one of his works. You know what I mean? It was that kind of thing. But the performance artists did strange stuff, you know, and I got pretty involved in their work, and I started to write about them. So it occurred to me to write a screenplay about a guy, a performance artist who is already a bizarre character, whose father was a guy like Kosman, who was a businessman, but also a performance artist in his own way, but who, and they clashed, sort of like Tony Soprano and his son, you know, and AJ, you know, just, there was always a clash. So I wrote a screenplay based on that. I only showed that to one person, Brad Davis. And I don't know if you know who Brad Davis is, but Brad Davis was the star of Midnight Express. And he was a very good actor. And then Brad Davis died. But he and I were asked to judge a dance contest at Universal Studios. And we got to know each other. So, you know, I said, hey, you know, you'd be perfect for this performance artist guy. And he read it. He wanted to do it. It was great, you know, but he died and nothing happened. I put the thing away and went on to another one. I wrote a genetic engineering thriller called Helix. And that had to do with having babies. You know, you go to a fertility clinic and you get an embryo. And the idea of this one was that you got a second embryo that you didn't know about. And one was black and one was white. It was a pretty powerful screenplay. Again, I sold the idea of it. Somebody paid us to write it. And then, again, the guy who put up the money, one of the richest men in Alaska, he died. So, all that fell over. So, you know, this is what happened. You know, I mean, Pacino liked the script a lot. You know, I thought he might do it, but that didn't happen. One is called Anything for a Laugh. That's based on high school years. It's sort of my American Pie kind of, you know, movie. Oh, The Black Eyes of Allah. This is based on a dream I had. And it was a very scary dream. I dreamt this thing over the years. Every 2 or 3 years, the same dream came back. And it was like a nightmare about a young couple who are leaving the Peace Corps, you know, idealistic. And they're leaving Africa. And they're going to the Seychelles Islands on a cargo boat and working their way there and then to India. And everything that can go wrong goes wrong for this couple on the boat. And it's a really scary story. And it just troubled me. But I wrote it. And I wrote it first as a short story. And I actually published it in my book of short stories called The Narcissist, that the story is there. I also published I wrote the screenplay. And I published the screenplay in a book of mine as well. So both of those are available. Oliver Stone wanted to do it. Oliver Stone liked it. And he actually paid me some money to do it. But then what happened is Oliver had a falling out with the president of his company, and he decided he doesn't want to do any other work except his own work. So I got it back. And again, I haven't tried to sell any of these things. I don't have an agent because I'm too old and nobody gives a shit about, you know, somebody if you're over 40, basically. So I have scripts and I love writing these scripts. And I have this new book I wrote that came out recently is called Turquoise. It's about my life in Ghana, but it's a relationship I had with this young African boy, and we became very close. And so we had a lot of different kinds of adventures. And then there's a love story because I fell in love with a young woman who's now a very famous journalist. So between the triangle of the relationship with this Ghanaian young boy who's in his 20s, and the young woman and myself, it's a few people who have read this thing said you should write a screenplay based on this. This is a good story idea, and it is a good idea, but I haven't gotten around to it. anybody out there wants me to do it, I'm happy to do it.
Yes, I know. Get this man's movies made.
Yeah, really. Before I die, I'd like to see one movie done.
Awesome. Well, Larry, thank you so much for sharing all your stories with me today. You have lived an amazing life. I know we could hear so many more, but unfortunately, I can only record an hour on here before it cuts off. So thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. Learn everything you need to know about the festival at burbankfilmfest.org.